Chapter 8. Only God is perfect. Like the creation story, the story of the fall in Genesis 3 is one of those episodes in scripture that anyone acquainted with the Bible seems to know, but there's more to the story than meets the eye. Over the next few chapters, I'll draw attention to some of the often overlooked details in the story and the questions they raise. What we've covered in earlier chapters serves as a crucial backdrop for understanding the fall. Eden was both the divine abode and the nerve center for God's plan for earth. The worldview of the biblical writer was, where Yahweh is, so is his counsel. Yahweh has announced his intention to create humankind as his imagers, Genesis 1:26. The council members heard that these humans, new members in Yahweh's family, would be tasked with overspreading the earth, advancing God's kingdom rule. They were Yahweh's choice to be steward kings over a global Eden under his authority. We'll soon see that one divine being dissented. But how could there be trouble in paradise? How could things have gone so wrong? The book of Job contains some of the clues. The backdrop. Job is an odd book. That's part of what makes it so interesting. The story opens with a divine council scene. The sons of God appear before Yahweh, Job 1:6. During the council meeting, the Satan shows up. His rank is not clear. The language is ambiguous with respect to whether he is of the same level as the sons of God or on the scene as a servant official to the council. The lower status is more likely, given what we learn about his job. I use the phrase, the Satan, deliberately. The Hebrew Satan means something like adversary, prosecutor, or challenger. It speaks of an official legal function within a ruling body, in this case, Yahweh's counsel. When Yahweh asks the Satan where he has been, we learn that Job involves investigating what we learn that his job involves investigating what is happening on earth, Job 1:7. He is, so to speak, Yahweh's eyes and ears on the ground, reporting what he has seen and heard. The Satan in Job 1:2 is not a villain. He's doing the job assigned to him by God. The book of Job does not identify the Satan in this scene as the serpent of Genesis 3, the figure known in the New Testament as the devil. The Old Testament never uses the word Satan of the serpent figure of Genesis 3. In fact, the word Satan is not a proper personal noun in the Old Testament. Old Testament scholars are well aware of all this. Their conclusion that Satan is not a proper personal name in the Old Testament is driven by Hebrew grammar. Like English, Hebrew does not attach the definite article, the word the, to proper personal nouns. English speakers do not refer to themselves or to other person with phrases like the Tom or the Sally. I'm not the Mike. English doesn't use the definite article with personal names. Neither does Hebrew. Most of the 27 occurrences of Satan in the Hebrew Bible, however, do indeed have the definite article, including all the places English readers presume the devil is present. Job 1, 6-9, 12, 2, verses 1 through 4, and 6 through 7. Zechariah 3, verses 1 and 2. The Satan described in these passages is not the devil. Rather, he's an anonymous prosecutor, as it were, fulfilling a role in Yahweh's counsel, bringing an accusatory report. The instances of Satan in the Old Testament that lack the definite article also don't refer to the devil or the serpent figure. Those occurrences describe either humans or the angel of Yahweh, who is occasionally sent by God to oppose someone or execute judgment, for example, in Numbers 22, verses 22-23. The function of the office of the Satan is why later Jewish writings began to adopt it as a proper name for the serpent figure from Genesis 3, who brought ruin to Eden. That figure opposed to God's choices for his human imagers. The dark figure of Genesis 3 was eventually thought of as the mother of all adversaries, and so the label Satan got stuck to him. He deserved it. The point here is only that the Old Testament doesn't use that term for the divine criminal of Eden. In Job 1, the Satan and God converse about Job. The Satan gets a bit uppity, challenging God about Job's integrity. We know the rest of the story. God gives Satan enough latitude to prove himself wrong, albeit at Job's expense. The beginning of Job is of interest to us because of two statements later in the book. In Job 4, one of Job's friends, Eliphaz, responds to Job's lament and wish for death, Job 3:11. He's not much of a comfort. He questions Job's belief that he has done nothing deserving of suffering, Job 4:6, something the reader knows is actually true, Job 1:8. Eliphaz says at one point, "Can a human being be more righteous than God? Or can a man be more pure than his maker?" Look, he does not trust in his servants, and he charges his angels with error. How much more dwellers in clay houses, whose foundation is in the dust? They are crushed like a moth. Job 4, verses 17 through 19. "Who do you think you are, Job? A man isn't more righteous than his maker. Why would God consider you blameless when he doesn't even look at his heavenly messengers that way?" Eliphaz repeats the thought in Job 15, verses 14 and 15. "What is a human being that he can be clean, or that one born of a woman can be righteous? Look, he does not trust his holy ones, and the heavens are not clean in his eyes." What Eliphaz says is significant. Here are two scriptural statements that God's heavenly council members are corruptible. They are not perfect. That's not terribly profound on the surface. The only truly perfect being is God himself. God never actually said that Job was incorruptible and perfect, only that he was blameless at the time of the council meeting. God knows that Job could indeed fail, just like the divine beings in his council. Even the lesser Elohim cannot be completely trusted. Free imagers. God knows that none of his imagers, divine or human, can be completely trusted. The reason is straightforward. Though imagers are like God, they aren't God. That's a truth we know all too well from our own struggles and experiences in a fallen world. Without genuine free will, imagers cannot truly represent God. We saw earlier that the image of God is not an attribute or ability. Rather, it's a status conferred by God on all humans, that of representing God. God created humankind to extend Eden over all the earth. That's what the commands of Genesis 1:27 collectively referred to by theologians as the dominion mandate are about. Humanity was to multiply, steward the creation, and govern on God's behalf. The goal was to care for the earth and harness its gifts for betterment of fellow human imagers, all the while enjoying the presence of God. How all that happens in our post-fall world varies from person to person. In our experience, humans have widely differing abilities. Some never see birth due to natural death or abortion. Others manifest in their bodies the effects of a world that isn't Eden. Some human beings have severe mental and physical defects that impede or prevent representing God according to the original vision. And even if we were blessed with what we consider normal health, we're all subject to disease, injury, aging, and the weakness of a world subject to corruption. But imaging is bound to our humanity. Regardless of ability or stage, human life is sacred precisely because we are the creatures God put on earth to represent Him. Humans who survive birth without suffering severe impairment, however, are able to represent God as originally intended. They do so by means of a spectrum of abilities we have as humans. These abilities are part of our being, like God. They are attributes we share with God, such as intelligence and creativity. The attributes God shared with us are the means to imaging, not the image status itself. Imaging status and our attributes are related but not identical concepts. One of these attributes is freedom, free will that reveals itself in decision-making. If humanity had not been created with genuine freedom, representation of God would have been impossible. Humans would not mirror their maker. They could not accurately image Him. God is no robot. We are reflections of a free being, not a cosmic automaton. Put it another way, God did not intend to create imagers that did nothing. True, even if an imager accomplished nothing, say an aborted human fetus, they would still be an imager. But God's original intent was to arm His imagers with both the will and the ability to carry out His decrees. Representation of God as His imagers and possession of free will are inextricably related. Since the lesser Elohim were also created as God's imagers, they too must have free will. Both human and non-human imagers are less than their maker. Only God is perfect in the possession and exercise of His attributes. Every lesser being is imperfect. The only perfect being is God. That is why things could and did go wrong in Eden. If that was true even in Eden, the place on earth where the council was present, then being in the presence of God is no guarantee that free will beings will never stray or act out of self-will. Only God is perfect. Beings that are lesser than God, whether human or divine, are not perfect. The potential for error and disobedience is by definition possible. Trouble could happen in paradise, and of course it did. God's decision to create free imagers involved that risk. You might think that all the risk was ours. After all, the world of humanity has suffered in its wake. But the only way in which there was no risk involved for God is if you define risk as threat of harm. God cannot be harmed. But He can be grieved. He is moved by human sin and suffering. Genesis 6:6, Isaiah 54:6-7. God was willing to risk that to have humanity. What we've learned leaves us with important questions. Even though free will is necessitated by imaging and representation, is risk the right word to use of God's decision? If God foreknew all the things that would happen as a result of His decision, didn't He also predestine those things? But if He did, how can we even talk about free will? How are Adam and Eve truly responsible? What about the notion that they would know good and evil, Genesis 3:5, and be like God? Does that mean God has an evil streak in Him? These questions have long been debated. It may therefore surprise you when I say they all have straightforward answers. What we've seen in this and earlier chapters about Eden, God, and His divine counsel prepares us for the answers. God does not delight in evil and suffering, nor does He need it for His sovereign plan. The conundrums evaporate if we just allow the text to say what it says. We need to lay our theological systems aside, answer these questions like an ancient Israelite would have, and embrace the results.